from SDPB Radio. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Roads and highways around the state are in rough shape, with some still flooded from heavy rains and last winter's ice melt. Reservation roads face the same challenges, but some tribal leaders say they don't have the money to make required fixes. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
I'm here at Lake Andes, next to Highway 18. The afternoon sun is glistening off of water that's covered up a good stretch of the highway. Sandbags are piled in some section to try and keep the water from reaching any more of the town. The Yankton Sioux tribe says flooding like this has been a problem in the area for months. Bonnie Zephyr is the tribe's transportation planner. She says the problem started with heavy rainfall in December that turned to ice.
All the culverts were frozen shut. So when we got the rain in March, it just didn't have any place to go, so it just went over the roads. Highway 46 here was closed like two or three times throughout this whole rain season.
A large part of the Yankton Sioux Reservation runs just north of the Missouri River. It's a checkerboard of reservation, state, and private land. What it all has in common is too much water. This year, Zephyr says storms in March, April, and September raised water levels in Lake Andes and flooded land and a number of BIA roads.
At one time, we had three roads closed at once, and that's nothing compared to other tribes, you know, after we heard about it, but two are closed now.
High water flooded two residential walkways, forcing residents near Lake Andes to walk next to fast-moving highway traffic. Also near the lake, BIA Route 1228 includes a section of road between Highway 50 and a county-owned road. The state raised Highway 50 by 4 feet this summer to prevent even more flooding. But then another storm pushed Lake Andes water levels high enough to cover even the newly constructed section of Highway 50. Zephyr says the tribe was able to do some emergency repairs, but needs reimbursement or emergency funding for larger projects like rebuilding walkways and roads.
So right away, we started doing weekly natural event reports to the BIA, and that was on all the damage and how much we expended or how much was needed. And they were supposed to try to find emergency funding for tribes.
And by April, the reports estimated road damage that totaled around $100,000. The number is higher now. Zephyr says the Great Plains Regional Bureau of Indian Affairs doesn't have enough money to fix all of the damage to the Yankton Sioux Tribe's BIA routes. The Bureau is responsible for maintaining BIA roads for all tribes. The tribe has requested emergency repair funds from the federal government, but Zephyr says some tribes have been waiting nearly a year and a half for reimbursement. And tribes with less money, like Cheyenne River, can't pay for emergency repairs up front. In those cases, the work doesn't get done until the money comes in. Louis Gallas Jr. is with Yankton Sioux Tribe's Road Maintenance Department. He says the BIA did provide $100,000 when flooding started affecting tribal members' housing.
That's been spent on berms and materials and whatnot, and pumps, and I'm not sure how much money they have left, but I'm pretty sure it's probably expended.
Gallas says three families near Lake Andes have had to move, and they're watching water levels for eight more houses. He says nearby BIA routes are also affected.
It started to subside a little, but then we got this other big rainstorm, and it's still underwater, so it's actually farther underwater than it was the first time it flooded.
Flooding in the area has been relentless this year. Genevieve Giacardo is the communications coordinator with the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the Washington, D.C. office. In an email, she writes that the BIA has been working with tribes on road damage this year because of unprecedented amounts of rain. The BIA receives funding through a congressional appropriations process. Giacardo says the agency is working to locate emergency funding for repairs. She says the tribes establish priorities for road maintenance and replacement, and the BIA supports those projects as money is available. However, because of weather's unpredictability, sometimes priorities need to shift. George Giroux Sr. has been the director of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe's Road Maintenance Department for about 20 years. He says the roads are a constant problem.
Some of it is infrastructure problems. Some of the roads are built so far back, the drainage and stuff on them was not quite right, and so that could have been part of the problem. But a lot of it was due to lack of maintenance that should have been done on the road.
Guru has been scraping together money for equipment and repairs his whole career. He says they even use their own equipment to help other tribes repair roads.
We started to build that up, and since that time we started to do a lot of the maintenance that should have been done way back when. But we just didn't have the money, equipment, or the material to do it.
Each year, the federal government allocates a set amount of money for tribes that's based on their size and enrollment. Rosebud gets about $3.5 million, and Yankton nearly $1 million. The tribe allocates some of that money directly to local BIA to maintain roads.
That wasn't enough. It never was and still isn't enough.
Guru says grant programs and other forms of federal funding allow the tribe to maintain roads and BIA routes. He says BIA does inspections of roads and bridges, many of which were installed about 30 years ago. The BIA recently replaced three bridges, and Guru says two more were scheduled for replacement this year. But before construction started, heavy flooding washed out the road near one and collapsed part of another. The tribe paid for repairs from its annual federal funding.
So we ate the cost with that, and we're running a little short now because the funding is still late coming in, and so we're kind of skimping along right now.
The results of a wet year are even evident in the BIA-owned transportation office. Guru says they've had to do emergency roof repairs themselves with road tar to prevent indoor flooding. And they're bracing for another wet year.
One South Dakota lawmaker says the state needs to fulfill the financial promises of a 2013 criminal justice reform package. During a summer study on the state's controlled substances laws, the group also considered three legislative proposals aimed at reducing the recidivism rate. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Senate Bill 70, which is the sweeping criminal justice reform package passed over 6 years ago, is pushing the cost of dealing with drug crimes from the state down to the county. A legislative committee is finding that the state has not followed up with the proper dollars to address the intersection of South Dakota's meth issue and criminal justice system. Prosecutors still see offenders cycling through the courts rather than getting addiction treatment. Republican Steve Haugard is chair of the Offenses Regarding Controlled Substances Committee. He says there wasn't a clear plan on what to do with SB 70 and funding.
That's just one of the inherent problems in trying to establish something without having a structure from A to Z to follow through on it and actually fund it. So that, I think, needs to change. I think we need to shift resources in the direction of prevention, treatment, and supervision. And it seems to me that these dollars that would be involved are not as significant as the costs that we're experiencing in incarceration and all the social costs that go with the incarceration.
The legislative panel is still split on whether to reduce ingestion of a controlled substance from a felony to a misdemeanor. Lawmakers are also considering an evaluation process for offenders and an incentive program for counties that prioritize diversion programs from prison. The legislative committee meets on Friday, November 8th by teleconference, where they're expected to send a recommendation to the executive board.
Death row inmate Charles Russell Rhines was executed by lethal injection at 7:39 Monday night. There was a six-hour delay waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to consider three appeals. Once the appeals were denied, it took 37 minutes from Rhines leaving his holding cell to being pronounced dead. SDPB's Kara Hetland reports.
Protesters gathered outside the state penitentiary in Sioux Falls. About 30 people prayed and sang hymns in the hour leading up to the scheduled 1:30 execution of Charles Russell Rhines. Dennis Davis is the director of South Dakotans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. He says he spoke with Rhines this week. He says Rhines was nervous, but has fought for his life as long as he can. Davis wonders what message this execution is sending.
It seems like, you know, they want to clean out death row, which, you know, is legal. You know, so killing is illegal anywhere in the United States, most places in the world, unless it's done by the state or the country, and for some reason they call that death legal. That's never made much sense to me. So why would we want to kill someone who is killed to say that killing is wrong? And what does this say to our children? It's teaching them something.
Davis says while he accepts the execution, he wants to shift the culture away from the death penalty. He says for a conservative state, it's more cost-effective to sentence someone to life without parole. Rhines has appeared in court 16 times with appeals over the last 26 years. His final three appeals were before the U.S. Supreme Court and delayed the scheduled execution for about 6 hours. The court denied the request for a stay of execution. Inside the prison, Charles Rhines wore an orange prison-issued short-sleeved T-shirt. He was lying down, strapped to a table, and was covered with a white sheet up to his chest. He wore his glasses. Jack Caudill is with KEVN in Rapid City and served as a media witness. He says Rhines' speech was calm when asked if he had any last words.
I said, yes, I do. He said, Ed and Peggy Schaefer, I forgive you for your anger and hatred towards me. I pray to God that he forgives you for his anger and for your anger and hatred toward me. Thanks to my team. I love you all. Goodbye. Let's go.
An IV was started in his right arm and left hand. Ariel Zients is a reporter with the Rapid City Journal and served as a media witness.
It looks like he intentionally closed his eyes and did some normal blinking, and then he started to frequently blink. And then he said something that sounded like sis, definitely a one-syllable word that sounded like sis. And his head, at first he was looking up because that's where the mic was, but then he turned his head to the right, which was away from us, and his arm was out to the left, so we couldn't see his face. He did a big, deep, audible breath, and there was some more labored breathing, and then it got gentle, and that was by 8:33, so within I'm sorry, 7:33. So within a minute, all of that breathing was done. By 7:38, I would say he was already pretty pale, but I would say the color in his face and hands became pretty clammy, kind of grayish, whitish, bluish.
Charles Rhines was pronounced dead at 7:39 p.m. Attorney General Jason Roundsburg says justice was served. He did not want to talk about Charles Rhines.
Today, I would like to remember Donovan Schaefer, the victim who was brutally murdered by the killer who just met justice. Donovan was an intelligent man set to graduate from Western Dakota Tech. Donovan was an award-winning archer who loved hunting and fishing. Donovan was funny, kind, and a hard worker.
Roundsburg says if Donovan Schaefer was alive, he would be about to celebrate his 50th birthday. Instead, Donovan Schaefer is known as the 22-year-old donut shop employee who surprised Charles Rhines during a burglary and was stabbed multiple times. Donovan's mother says she forgave Charles Rhines a long time ago. She says that's the only way she could move on after her son's death. She says she's angry about the crime, but is not full of anger and hatred towards Rhines. She wants instead to honor her son.
The man who touched many lives without even knowing it. Today, do something kind for someone in honor, because life is just too short, and this world needs more love and kindness. Remember him today. Talk about Donovan. He is missed, and he is loved, and he will never be forgotten.
Peggy and Ed Schaefer believe justice was done and thanked law enforcement and state lawyers for working hard on behalf of their family. Donovan's fiance, Sheila Pond Jackson, told reporters Donovan believed in an eye for an eye and that justice was served for Donovan. No one spoke from Charles Rhine's family. He was the fifth inmate to be executed since 2007. One inmate remains on South Dakota's death row. The South Dakota Supreme Court is currently reviewing the recent appeal by Briley Piper.
Applied Behavior Analysis, or ABA therapy, is one of the most effective treatments for children with autism. But South Dakota families lost health insurance coverage for the expense of therapy earlier this year. The state since added ABA therapy to its benchmark plan under the Affordable Care Act for 2021. But some families are still without coverage despite a compromise between Sanford and Avera health plans.
Sanford and Avera health plans are offering ABA coverage options directly through their websites to bridge the 2020 coverage gap before the new benchmark plan takes effect. However, the option came too late to be posted on the healthcare.gov exchange. Darcy Weber runs her own ABA therapy business in Watertown, and her fiancé is a farmer. She says it's difficult for two small business owners to find a plan that's affordable to keep her son Easton in ABA therapy.
We use the exchange to help us with the tax bracket for him to get insurance that's affordable for our family because we make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough for us to be able to afford the $500 a month plans, you know.
Weber says only about half of families she knows are able to afford the 2020 options through Sanford or Avera. Lindsay Janklow of Sioux Falls is insured through her employer's plan with Blue Cross Blue Shield, who did not offer a 2020 option. She's paying out of pocket to keep her son RJ in therapy.
We have about, $60,000 probably racked up in bills right now. And right now we're paying on a payment plan, so it's kind of a nightmare, but, you know, your brain only develops once, and so this is kind of a critical window for him to get the therapy that he needs.
Janklow notes the 2021 benchmark puts limits on ABA coverage based on age and hours per week. She says those limits still won't cover her son's therapy costs entirely. The 2020 plans through Sanford and Avera that include ABA therapy are available for open enrollment until December 15th. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
An Egyptian trade delegation arrived in Sioux Falls Sunday night. They've been spending time touring eastern South Dakota to visit with producers, technology experts, and people in agribusiness. SDPB's Steve Zwemke met with Ambassador Hamdi Saleh and State Representatives Michael Saba and Skylar Borglum Sunday night to discuss the trade mission and finding ways to bring new dollars into South Dakota.
Mike, would you take me back to the start and why this visit was put together and how South Dakotans can benefit from this exchange?
Watching the world go around us here and seeing the importance of opening up agricultural markets now, particularly it's been magnified with the tariffs. In the state legislature this year, when I served, I talked very often about the situation that we needed to open up other markets. And in fact, I helped to bring in a delegation from Europe into the state legislature so we could meet with them and talk with them. I think people in the state legislature were concerned that the tariffs were hurting us, but most of it was complaints. Most of it was, let's hope that we get through this. Let's hope that the president works it out. But nobody was really doing anything on the other side. And one of the real deficits we were experiencing in this whole situation was there was no backup plan. We had the tariffs, you know, being put on. I think there was an assumption that it would be worked out relatively quickly. It wasn't. And so I started during the legislature. And then I decided that, again, when I saw that the state doesn't really have an office for international trade, and in addition to that, the state office that has historically worked with international trade didn't even have any trade delegations set up for this year. So I took it upon myself after the legislature was out. I actually spoke at a conference, a UN conference, that was hosted by Ambassador Hamdi Saleh, who we'll hear from in just a minute, where we talked with many, many countries about coming to South Dakota, seeing what we have to offer. And a follow-up to that was visiting with the ambassador, more so, going to the Middle East this summer and visiting various countries, including the country that the ambassador is from, Egypt, as well as Lebanon and Jordan, and bringing, putting together trade delegations from all three of those countries to come in. They're all of those countries do purchase U.S. soybeans. They purchase U.S. corn, purchase U.S. wheat. But South Dakota has been too long a flyover state. So the idea behind this was to bring these folks that are looking for purchasing the kind of products we have directly to South Dakota, to work directly with the possible sales that can take place.
You've also championed this as an opportunity to work across the aisle with another legislator here in South Dakota, Skylar Borglum. And Skylar, Mike has really pumped up the working across the aisle issue here. Go ahead and talk about that a little bit, how it's been working with Representative Seba on this project, and where you see this going, this working with other countries to try to bring some dollars into South Dakota.
Well, I'm glad to hear you focusing on across the aisle and not the great divide that is the East-West River chasm. So yes, he and I are crossing both together. I have been delighted to be invited by Representative Seba to work on this project. We are in agreement very much so that South Dakota needs new dollars. We need more dollars and we need trading partners. That is not a partisan decision. That is not a partisan question. That is what's best for South Dakota and how do we start competing on the national and international level. Having visited and toured many great companies in this state and met people across the state, I know that this is something we are more than capable of engaging with. So working with Representative Seba, it was a natural fit. Both of us see tremendous opportunity for South Dakota, and we see tremendous opportunity in South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And we're having a really good time doing it.
Ambassador Saleh, it's nice to have you here in South Dakota. Welcome, first of all. And go ahead and, first of all, tell me about what you do in your position in Egypt.
Basically, I'm advisor to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but, you know, I'm helping a large number of business people, business groups, to try to develop their relations, international relations, and so on. And let me come back to the subject about this particular trade mission, because this is basically what I'd like to talk about. As Mr. Seba talked about, we are friends for a long time, and we actually dealt with him also before that in Dakotas, in North and South Dakota for that. But lately when we met in the UN, this idea came that, you know, it will be beneficial to both sides that, you know, we can develop a long-term type of relationship between not only Egypt and South Dakota, but Egypt as really representing the Middle East at large, particularly the stable part of the Middle East. So we are here as a small group of business people, but representing a larger number of people over there who would like to come later on, not only to make a deal, one deal, but to develop a long time for the future, a long time relationship, a cooperation in terms of importing your product, in terms of cooperation in technology transfer, in terms of cooperation in several other areas in agriculture. And this particular trade mission is focused on agriculture. They are more or less, you know, people who started as farmers but developed into a big business and so on. So we think that this will be an exploratory trip, but at least one or two deals will be done. They are focused on the soybean and the corn and so on. But exploratory in terms that, you know, they would like to know. I know a little bit more because of my friendship with Michael and with my relationship with the representative, Sinclair. But, you know, they don't know. And not everybody over there in the Middle East know exactly what are the potentials of South Dakota and North Dakota and so on. So what we'd like to do is, A, to start the process, to get something done, maybe small, maybe not very, very large at this particular time, a deal at least in the soybean and the corn, and to maybe develop a joint venture in a number of areas and so on. But to start that as a process, we will bring larger number of business people later on and to really work out something which will be beneficial to both sides. What was really encouraging is the fact that, you know, as Michael said, that the environment, the international environment, it's changing. And as a result of that, both of us, we need each other. We need each other because you are trying really to move on, really protecting your own economy. And as a result of that, there is some, you know, tension here and there between some countries, and some of your products might be a little bit less expensive. We need also to develop some relationship with the people who are really the real producers, not only to go to the multinational Cargill and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's our focus in this particular trip, to explore, to put together something as a process, and to do at least one or two deals.
Do you see this also as a cultural exchange, this visit, and possibly something that would develop into like more of even a tourism exchange between countries?
We hope so. Of course, this is a very difficult process. There would be a few meetings with the universities here. We'd like to develop relations with the universities. This is very important, and I thank Representative Michael Saba for this, and Representative St. Clair for this. But also, we would like later on to develop a relationship between the city and the city, sister city relationship, and then maybe to see governor to governor relationship. The problem is, you know, America for some time thought that, you know, they don't need to move as fast as they did in the past. And as a result of that, they left the market in the Middle East and in Africa to China and to other countries. You know, and now it's about time that Americans come to their, you know, long time dynamism and start again moving, you know, to, you know, one step from our side, you're still from your side. Mm-hmm. And things will move very, very fast because there is an old friendship between the Middle East, but between Egypt and the United States in general, and particularly this part of the United States who are really people who are more focused on the land and the real producers and so on. So I think we have big potential for cooperation in the future.
Representative Saba, let me come back to you. As we've been talking about, this is a very agricultural focused trip, and by looking at the schedule, you've told me about the schedule over the last few days. It certainly is. It starts early tomorrow morning. Go ahead and give me some of the highlights of the schedule as it pertains to agriculture, and maybe we can ask some particular questions as we do that.
Well, other than the fact that we may drive down the road to see the falls yet tonight, there really isn't much time being spent seeing our beautiful state for all of those things. They are here seriously to look at agri-technology and agricultural products, and also to look at the way that we might help Egypt in terms of their land reclamation and in terms of their producing greater amounts of crops, of their own crops. So we're concentrating on that. We're starting tomorrow with Eros, going out to the center that has some incredible information about Egypt itself. And then we move on to POET and see what they produce. Then we move to a number of biotechnology companies that we're having lunch with. And then out to Walt Bones' farm, which is on the eastern, you know, the western side of outside of Sioux Falls. And they'll probably get on combines because he's harvesting. I don't know, Ambassador Saleh, if you've ever been on a combine, but you will tomorrow. You'll be on a combine tomorrow.
Looking forward, yeah.
From there, the next day we go up to Brookings. We're at SDSU, meeting with precision agriculture people, which I think you'll find extremely interesting and relevant. Hopefully, you'll send some of your students to the South Dakota State University. Then we'll be seeing some people right outside of Brookings. There's a soybean plant, and there's a plant that produces animal feed from soybeans. Mm-hmm. So you'll see some of the downstream products from soybeans. Mm-hmm. Additionally, we'll go tomorrow night to Watertown, where the Lake Area Technical Institute is hosting you. And they have a number of different companies that are agri-technology companies, mm-hmm. and some excellent training programs. And then over to Aberdeen, where we'll go to AgTegra, which is one of the largest companies in this part of the United States in terms of 5,000 co-op members producing wheat, corn, soybeans, the very things you're looking for. Sure. But in large quantities, the kinds of quantities you're looking for. And then we'll meet with a meat packing plant that actually produces halal beef. Mm. So this is, which is beef that is slaughtered in the way that you utilize in your country. Yeah. And so you'll have a chance to see all of these. You'll have a chance to learn about our technology, and you'll also have a chance to hopefully purchase some of our technology and products.
Very good. Yeah.
Ambassador Saleh, I'm curious about, as we discuss agriculture, I'm curious about how the climate in Egypt is different from the climate here in South Dakota, and how your needs with respect to farming, farming tools might be different than ours.
Actually, well, once I started this process of putting together a group to come to North Dakota, I was bombarded, and our group was bombarded with questions, what we can do with America at large. They don't look to North, to South Dakota as South Dakota alone. Look, they look at it, to, it is a state which is representing the American market and the American, you know, society at large. So I was bombarded with questions like what we talked about, the climate change, that they are searching for technology which really can help in really protecting the plantation from the climate change. And they say that, you know, that they read about, you know, American technology helping that. They are also talking about seeds. They are talking about several things which are related to, you know, the plantation itself, how to develop, you know, a more healthy and organic plantation and medical plantation and so on. So in a sense, the needs are very diversified. It's not only focused on what, you know, the relativity, similarity in climate between South Dakota and Egypt, for example, no. But in America, you have the climate which is very similar to Egypt, which is Florida, California, and Arizona, and so on. It's almost the same. So we can work with partners in South Dakota to bring us the same technology and the same things from all over the United States, from California, from there, whatever. So it's not the issue really to focus on. That's one thing. But the second thing, we are talking about importing a large amount, very large amount of soybeans. The animal feeds in Egypt is in a crisis, and they buy it from several sources in the East and Eastern Europe. And, you know, they say the quality here is different, better, and so on. And they are very much interested in really expanding their importation from here. How we can develop that? This is a formula which we are working on. That's why we brought with us actually a financial expert who can really work out the financing process and so on. Mm-hmm. So we have a big potential. Whether the climate is different or not, that's not the issue, because we can really work together and through your connections from all over the country, we can work on several projects.
Representative Borglum, as we continue talking about agriculture, you know as well as anybody how hard our soybean producers were hit this past year due to the weather. To hear what's happening this week in South Dakota with the delegation from Egypt has to be good news for them. Can you talk a little bit more about our farmers, what their needs are as far as being able to export, and especially in the area of soybeans?
Absolutely. So the first thing that our farmers need to have is hope, right? That this year, as hard as it was, and it was incredibly difficult across the state, that this next year they have a reason to get back out there and get planting, because there is a market who wants our soybeans. One of the reasons I love working on this project with Representative Saba and the ambassador is because I know the product that we put out as a state is superior to many, if not all, the producers across the country. So we can take our product and take it to a specific market and say, this is the best, and this is what you have in front of you. This is something that when you buy it, you know you're getting top quality. And so our farmers know that with Representative Saba and myself and the ambassador and the experts, this is a tremendous group. The small group we have here is only a tiny bit of us. There is nearly a dozen, if I'm not mistaken, covering all aspects of international trade, putting the deal together so that we can get it done right, showcasing the best of what we have, which is what Representative Saba has done. So having all of this in place means that when the farmers harvest their soybeans next year and harvest their corn, they know that we want them to have access to ready buyers who recognize the quality we have to offer.
Representative Saba, I want to get back to something you touched on a moment ago, and that was the production of halal beef here in South Dakota. You've explained to me over the last few weeks that it's been a matter of producers having to go through Iowa in a plant in Iowa, but now that's different here in South Dakota.
Really, when we talk about halal beef, we're talking about the beef that's slayed in the traditional Muslim way, mm-hmm. and as very similar to kosher beef in the Jewish way, and it's a relatively easy process. The point being here that as Ambassador Saleh said, and this is very important what he said, look at us as a gateway to that whole region. Okay, the whole region can be, you know, accessed through us and with us. And when you're talking about not only the region, but you're talking about 1.5 billion Muslims in the world that eat halal meats, Iowa has already adapted to that market. They have a large production of halal beef, halal chicken, halal lamb, and are the largest exporter to Malaysia and I believe even Saudi Arabia, a couple of companies over there. They've developed that market. We produce better beef than Iowa, I would say. Okay? So it's not a matter of
They might argue the corn issue.
They might. Okay. But so it's a matter of setting up that, assisting our industry that already exists in terms of not only opening a new product, but opening a brand new market in the process. So you're talking about a huge, huge market out there. And this market is growing in size. And it's also growing in quality consciousness. We produce this high quality. We should be doing this and adopting to that market. Mm-hmm. And I think with opportunities like this, with folks like the ambassador here and his delegation, they'll look at that. They'll take that back. They'll see what they can do, I think, in terms of opening it up with us.
Ambassador, I'd like to ask you a question about the purchase of farm equipment, implement, if you will. President Trump has been working on a phase one deal that they're calling it. And I think there's still a lot of questions as to what's happening with that. He says what the U.S. would like to do is sell between $40 to $60 billion worth of farm equipment. And he says some of that is already being sold right now. I'm just wondering, is Egypt buying any farm equipment right now from the United States?
I don't know whether how definitely they are buying from the United States, but how big is a question usually. Because Egypt is a large country, it's 105 million people and so on. But as Michael said, the Middle East is interlinked to each other. So basically, like the business people we have here, they already have offices in Saudi Arabia, companies in Emirates and so on. So basically, they are working across the region. So they are not only importing from here to Egypt, but importing from here to Saudi Arabia and to the Emirates and to Kuwait and so on. So the interlink is there. But let me move from this point to another point, which is very important. When Michael, is talking about, the halal meat and so on, reminded me. Basically, this state needs a little bit to really move on to present itself to the world. And this is an important message, probably, which I'd like to mention, that this is a great state, and I think that you can really do a lot if you have, more action in terms of internationalization. And that's one of the ideas I'm going to discuss with the people who I'm meeting with them here, the universities and other, institutions, that probably if we can develop some orientation for the people, either in the government or in the business community, how to do business internationally, either in the Middle East or in Eastern Europe or whatever, I think that will be very helpful for both sides. And I think this orientation of how to really seize the opportunity will be a very, very useful for both sides. Because what, as an ambassador, I watched China invading Africa, really taking the market. It's unbelievable. And they are using different type of, behavior, which Americans are not accustomed to. And, you have laws here against, anything which is not really very... it's about time that America can really come back. And I think President Trump is really serious about that, and I think we should work together on this, bringing America back to the Middle East, to the Africa, and to these traditional markets, which usually in the past you were active, but for some reason not to the point which we would like to be at this point.
Some of the things that you'll tour and observe this week are dealing with precision agriculture, biotechnology. Where is Egypt in comparison to where the United States is with respect to some of those more advanced farming techniques?
Basically, they have they have ambitions to really get into this very high level of technology, the cutting edge of technology. And that's why they are here, and that's why I was bombarded with questions about so many things. I have a list of things which we are going to talk about in terms of all these points which you talked about and others as well. So the country is moving, and I think they will have a big potential in the future. And as I mentioned again, that, you know, it's not only the Egypt and at itself, but Egypt as representing, you know, the linkages which they have both in Africa and the Middle East. I think that's important. So the focus on technology and American technology in particular is there. And we would like to expand that into cooperation in these in several areas in technology.
Right. Representative Borglum, Michael mentioned this just a few minutes ago, and so did the ambassador. Speaking of South Dakota positioning themselves better to do business, talk about that for a little bit and exactly what you expect to get out of this visit from our Egyptian delegation and into the future with our dealings in business and positioning ourselves, like I said, better.
One of the things I'm most proud of with this trip and with the Egyptian delegation coming to South Dakota and the work that Representative Seva has done is we get to showcase the highest possible quality. And that is what we produce here, whether it is in terms of our agriculture or our beef or the technology that goes with it. We put out a fine, fine piece of work. And what happens is when it goes to the general market, that quality can get diluted down. And then the price that our farmers and ranchers get is lower than what they should be getting. Now, if we are able to go straight to the market who wants our high quality product, they get a better piece, we get a better price, and everybody walks away happy. And that's how it should be. That's the point of trade. And so for me, being a part of this and getting to see it, it really is, frankly, cutting out the middleman, cutting out unnecessary expense, cutting out unnecessary bureaucracy, right? Yeah, I mean, all of it. And so if we can give our farmers and our ranchers and our technological experts that edge and get them right up to the people who want it and have much better interaction, so there's faster feedback, there's faster response time, there's clearer understanding of both sides, what they want and what they're trying to achieve, I see that as a win for everybody. And I really see this as the inaugural event for South Dakota. And what we start here this week between South Dakota and Egypt, who knows where this can take off and what it can do for our economy.
It wasn't that long ago that I remember the governor going on out-of-country trips on trade visits, mm-hmm. and we would invite business leaders from South Dakota onto our program, and it's been a while since we've had that happen. And Michael, you've talked about that here at the state level, that we haven't had as many of those trips as we used to. As we move into the 2020 legislative session, is this something that you will want to emphasize with the rest of our lawmakers and show this as an example of what we should be doing more of?
Absolutely. And again, I want to thank the work that Representative Borglum has done together with me to stimulate that in the last legislative session. There's kind of a fear there, I think, of that international marketplace. Even if there shouldn't be a fear, just for fear's sake, there shouldn't be, because 70% of our economy in this state is based on agriculture, and between 40 and 50% of that's based on export. So we are already hugely in the national marketplace, but we're at a second and third and fourth level. We're trying to gain access at a primary level. And as Representative Borglum said, I think this trip can be transformational for South Dakota. I know it can be transformational. And I want to particularly thank Ambassador Saleh for putting together the delegation. There are 49 other states he could be in right now, mm-hmm. and he's here in South
yes,
Dakota.
Exactly.
And he's here, when he talks about getting to the primary market, there are 49 other primary markets, but he's here now. He's going to be with us for 3 or 4 days, and we want to take full advantage of this. And I want our producers to be right here to meet them and to talk with them. We've tried to set up as good a trip as we could, but, you know, we never have enough time. But we do have time to really show him what we have. And I thank him particularly for bringing this delegation here.
I cannot emphasize more this idea of really connecting the importers to the producer themselves. Because I, as an ambassador and as somebody who witnessed it for a long time, we have been exploited by the middleman. It's not a man. It is really a very giant multinationals who really play the game on a very high level. So we have been importing the same material from South Dakota, and we don't know it's coming from South Dakota. It's coming from Cargill. It's coming from another company. So it's about time that we really benefit from a direct relationship. And putting together that formula will start a process which will be very seriously considered by others, and it will be very beneficial for both sides. So I think this is a very important thing to try to work on.
I might say that with regards to what the ambassador has just said, the opportunities are here. In addition to what we're doing with visiting the farming community and the agricultural community, we are also visiting some of the university heads to talk about, okay, we have farming, we have agriculture, we have products that we produce, but the universities often serve as an intermediary with their international programs they develop. We need to do a lot more of that. We need to develop international programs. Mm-hmm. And, we always talk about the young people leaving South Dakota, whether it's farm people because they're just tired of the fact that farming is put so low on the totem pole in this country, or whether it's academics who want to see the world. Well, we can bring the world to South Dakota. We're doing that. And by doing that, that really bridges this whole gap that exists. We don't want to be a flyover state. And we're so happy when the ambassador says, you're not going to be a flyover state in the future. You know, we're going to stop here and we're going to bring in other people to see what you have.
So we're no longer a flyover state, we're a fly-to state.
Fly-to state.
But not only that, basically what is needed in this state in the South Dakota is really to put the spot on the state and on the product and so on. They are already doing very good work, and they are, as the representative scholar said, there is something to be proud of. The point is how to present that to the others. And then if we can help in doing that, I think it will be beneficial to us and beneficial to you. So we can really do something which will be helpful and useful for the people in the Middle East at large and for Africa and for you. So I think it's about time that we do things together in this way.
Representative Saba spoke about bringing the world to South Dakota and bringing South Dakota to the world. How do we bring Egypt to South Dakota with respect to education?
Education, this is a very big issue because there is big potential for cooperation in education in terms of university level, in terms of research, in terms of exchange of expertise and so on. And we will start looking into that also again during this trip with meeting the two major universities. However, I think this would be only one step, for a long process, because education is not something which you can accomplish in a few days and so on. It is a matter of process which you can really start and let others get involved and move on. So if we are talking about students coming to this to the state, I think there would be a big potential for that. Already in the past, we have few students who are coming here and coming to North Dakota, but, in the future, I think we can have a larger number and so on. In the past, they used to go to the traditional areas like in Florida and California and Arizona and so on because of the climate. But now they became more challenging and things like that is not really preventing them. The climate will not be the issue. But what is the issue is really to feel that they are exploring new area and new land and connecting with people who are very friendly. And that's what I emphasize to my people, by the way, when I'm bringing them here. That you will deal with people like you, really friendly, really wanted to do something for themselves and for you. Not, the typical commercial people whom I don't want to say from which state, or from which city, but, where people are really doing with you like anybody else. But see, here is the people who can really develop friendship and business together.
There's one point that really needs to be made with this trip, and it's that we want to bring new dollars to the state of South Dakota. We don't want to recycle the dollars that are already here. We want to grow our economy, and we believe we have the best possible product to do that. So I am very much looking forward to working with the ambassador and the Egyptians.
Representative Saba.
Relationships. It starts with relationships. We had a wonderful meeting when they came in tonight with some of the hosts here, and Dr. Dave Kapaska came representing the Chamber of Commerce, Walt Bones, the farming community, Jerry Schmitz from the Soybean Association, and so on. And it was so heartening to see the warmth going back and forth. And that's what it's all about. It's relationships. As we enhance these relationships, we'll enhance the relationship between the people of South Dakota and the people of Egypt. And I look so forward to that. From the latest execution in South Dakota to the state legislature's efforts to hold the South Dakota Department of Education accountable for improving student test scores, the Dakota Political Junkies had much to discuss. Mike Card, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, and John Schaff, Professor of Political Science at Northern State University, made up this week's panel. They joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh on Wednesday.
All right, let's start with farm bankruptcies because they are on the rise. Not quite as bad as the 1980s, but significant. John Schaff, kick us off.
Yeah, I think this is explains there's so much anxiety in the ag field these days, and the ag part of our economy these days. And you look at, I was looking at recently soybean prices. Just trying to figure out, what is the market think of where things are going with trade, and the best way thing to do is to go look at, well, what's the market say? This tells us what's going to happen with trade. Is the market optimistic or not? And I detected some slight optimism because bean prices were slightly up. But when you compare bean prices to say 18 months ago, mm-hmm. and 24 months ago, and there's really no comparison. The prices are so low. The American farmer is in some way is a victim of his own success, is that we get such great yield, we're so productive. And the way that we keep our farm economy going is by giving new markets to our farmers. We're great on supply. What we need is to increase demand, and we do that through markets. And when you cut the biggest part of the biggest market in the world out in China, ag is really, really going to hurt. And so we see things that something like 40% of farm economy this year is going to be transfer payments, insurance payments, these kind of extra payments that the Trump administration has come up with to take into account some of the malign effects of trade policy. And so you feel that we hear over and over that a trade agreement is coming. I think for our farm economy, it can't happen soon enough.
Hmm. Professor Card, where does the political blame for that land? Does it?
Well, I think you have to go back many places, and one of which is the tariffs that our president has placed on trade with China is part of what has reduced the demand. I think the other part that we have to deal with is that China has made promises that they haven't been willing to live up to, all the way from joining the World Trade Organization, even to their promises to buy more soybeans. They simply haven't bought them. And now they're looking elsewhere in other markets, which we've seen recent activity in South Dakota with the Soybean Growers Association to look for other markets, because that by sourcing their soybeans elsewhere, China is probably going to stay there with that new market that they've uncovered for buying soybeans. So our soybean farmers and those in the corn and soybean states have to go out and find new markets. And it's not clear that how much the federal government is helping them. We have a legislator in South Dakota that brought some Egyptians to the state to try to find a new market. So I think that's a lot of it. But John also mentioned, and we need to reiterate, it's a victim of our own productivity. Our farmers are producing food to feed the world. Unfortunately, not all of the world either can or is willing to buy our soybeans.
Well, you can't vote against China, but you can cast a vote against a president. You can cast a vote for a state lawmaker or against one. You can cast a vote for your congressional delegation. John Schaff, do you think, as those numbers rise, as we see the bankruptcies surging to 24%, largely focusing on the Midwestern area, that it has political implications in 2020?
Yeah, no, I was thinking about South Dakota specific implications. And, I think back to 1986 when Tom Daschle defeated Jim Abner. Jim Abner, of course, was the incumbent U.S. Senator, and Tom Daschle was a member of the House of Representatives at the time, which granted is a pretty strong position to run for Senate from, especially in the state of South Dakota. But nonetheless, farms the farm policy was a big reason why Tom Daschle could unseat Jim Abner. And when Ronald Reagan came to the state late in that campaign, it's not clear whether Ronald Reagan coming to South Dakota to campaign for Jim Abner was a benefit or a harm, because the farmers were so angry at the Reagan administration. And when you see things like when the Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue was in Wisconsin, was like a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, and he's talking about dairy farming, but nonetheless, when he used the phrase "farmers got to get big or get out," that's not what our farmers want to hear, and that sounds exactly like what in the past has gotten farmers angry in the 1980s. It's what one of the things that helped George McGovern rise in the 1950s is Eisenhower administration officials saying nearly the exact same thing. And you wonder if there isn't an opportunity, if the Democrats can field credible candidates, as Republicans who feel beholden to the Trump administration and to tout themselves as more Trumpist than thou, if that can't be used in some circles against them. But that there's a variable I mentioned there. That's the Democrats fielding credible candidates, and that's something that
the party has struggled to do. Before the Democrats who are listening get too excited, I'm not hearing from any of the Democrats presidentially a whole lot about the farm economy. Of course, I haven't been following as closely yet. But Mike Card, does that leave an opportunity for people like Dan Ahlers or Skylar Borglum, some of the South Dakota candidates who are running for office, to lean heavy on what they're saying about the farm economy and how they would represent South Dakota and Washington?
Well, it certainly provides a little bit of an opportunity. South Dakota is sufficiently Republican by registration that our elected representatives can distance themselves from the president. Jim Abner in 1986 was damaged by the primary battle with Bill Janklow. Mm-hmm. And that certainly made the race much closer than it would have been otherwise. I guess that's my opinion. But I think most scholars of that study would say that's true. And that meant that Abner, who was a good, loyal Republican and followed the president, and he might have followed him right into defeat. Mm-hmm. Again, what John mentioned was is that the Democrats had a credible candidate. And we've got some candidates who are opposing our incumbent senator and incumbent representative in Congress. But I think there's sufficient room that our incumbents can distance themselves from the president.
And I'd like to start talking about the South Dakota Department of Education and a rather unusual, but I'm not sure if it's unprecedented, move from the oversight panel to say not good enough for South Dakota students with the budget that you have. Mike Card, start us off with how exactly this unfolded.
Well, I think the first part of this is to recognize that the legislature has oversight activities over the institutions of government in South Dakota. They certainly fund the Department of Education and give authorization for the Department of Education to spend money. So as part of that, the legislature has hired a program evaluator or two. I believe it's just one, but I'm not sure. And they have set forward expectations for the agencies to develop a plan to improve over time. And as a result of that, every agency has to report to the Government Operations and Audit Committee every 3 years, I believe. And as a result, the Department of Education is one of the agencies that was reporting this year. And the Government Operations and Audit Committee, or GOAC as they're called, noted that they've received about $200 million in authority to expend money, and their oversight is that the self-reported statistics regarding student performance and the quality of their education isn't increasing, and that's the proficiency rate standard. So they're taking an active step in assisting with oversight and wanting a plan to move forward and to move these proficiency rates higher. And at the same time, in South Dakota, local government is a special district called a school district, and they make most of the curricular decisions regarding education and how they're taught and evaluate the teachers and hire the teachers. So it's sort of the department is caught in the middle by providing technical assistance, but they don't actually deliver the education to the children of our state. Mm.
So for reference, according to an email from Chris Carr, who's on the committee, the English proficiency rate for third graders has been between 48% and 51%, with a five-year goal of 54%. The math proficiency rate for eighth graders has been between 39% to 47%, with a five-year goal of 52%. That's just a little bit from the validation or the argument to say we can do a lot better. John Schaff, talk about Ben Jones's kind of role in this, because when he came to the program here talking about the latest report, he fully admitted openly, like, there's a gap and we've got to do something about it.
Yeah, I think it's I feel for Dr. Jones, because it seems like he's been caught holding a stinky mess that somebody else created, so to speak. Because obviously he's been our Secretary of Education for, he was interim and then full time, so he's been in the position for, let's say, about a year and a half, almost 2 years here. But these are trends that have been occurring over a period of time, and as Secretary Jones mentioned in his testimony before the GOAC committee, is that one of the things that has happened is that over the last handful of years, we've had a change in how we test students and assess proficiency. As we went from, you might say, the No Child Left Behind years to the Common Core years, in the Obama years, one of the things that happened is that we changed the test that we use from the STEP test to the Smarter Balance test. And one of the things that Secretary Jones notes is that if we would have stayed with the STEP test, maybe we would have seen different rates of proficiency, because one of the things that's going on is we've had to kind of reset what does it mean to be proficient as we've moved from one test to another. And it's also, if we're talking about testing and we've got these five-year goals, if today we decide we want our proficiency rate in English amongst third graders to be this percentage, well, that's not going to happen next year. This is something that it takes a number of years to change curriculum, to change pedagogy, and then to see the results of that change. And so,
can I jump in real quick, John?
Sure.
Because what I'm wondering is, those tests are very different as a parent of a child in the school system. Like, we all know that, how those are they're starkly different. Is it the testing? Was the proficiency always that low and it just seemed like it was higher because we had a different test? Is this a flawed testing? What I'm getting at is how bad are the students actually and how bad is the testing material?
Well, one of the claims that some people have made is that the Smarter Balance test, the question is which of the tests are valid. And it's possible that neither are valid.
Right.
But there have been concerns, especially I would say like in mathematics, that the test simply wasn't a valid test, and these things are put together by committees. There's been, especially in mathematics education, there's been a revolution between what STEP was doing, what Smarter Balance is doing, what the way Common Core envisioned mathematics. There was a revolution in how they envisioned mathematics education, and whether that test is actually getting at what the students know. And in that sense, is it a valid test? And I've heard multiple people and people I trust on these matters, especially in mathematics, that the shift in the testing was inevitable, because people really didn't have people didn't really know what it meant to be proficient. So you have to run the test a few times to figure out, well, what can students do on this? What does it mean to be proficient? Because we've changed the testing regime. And to a certain degree, when these tests are put together, they're, as I say, they're put together by a committee, and they're sort of like throwing darts at a board. And I wouldn't be so sure that just because, and I believe in testing to a certain extent, but I wouldn't be so sure just because the percentages on people changing tests is different that students aren't learning what we want them to. But the big bugbear in education is always that it is extremely difficult to assess what we're doing because there are so many variables that go into student learning. You know, and Michael and I are both in education, granted at a higher education level, but it's always a struggle to figure out what is the best method, what is a valid measure of our students are doing what we want them to do, and it's extremely difficult to get a measure that is valid and pleases everybody.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thanks for listening.